Hello and welcome to Sense in Numbers, a podcast created and hosted by two people who have varying levels of experience in mental health issues. We are not mental health professionals, we just want to create a format for people to listen, share and find support in. Each episode will concentrate on different aspects of mental health illness, treatment and experience.
We also feel it pertinent to deliver a trigger warning due to the subject matter of the podcast. You may hear some distressing details and stories. There will also be some mature language and possibly my squeaky crying voice, so listener discretion is advised.
Hello everyone, just a quick note before this episode starts. It's probably a little bit disjointed. We started recording before Christmas and we're hoping to release the episode as soon as possible. Then with the impending national lockdown, thought that we should probably focus our efforts a bit more on that and some coping strategies for people. So it might seem a bit odd that it's like Christmas and then it's 2021 doomsday, but
that's us.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Sense in Numbers podcast. I am Gemino the Jingle Horse.
I like that. I'm Ben Meister General.
That's rubbish. It's not Christmassy at all.
I don't have to be Christmassy. Don't force me. Don't force your festivities inside of me.
Bit elaborate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us again.
Who's us? You and your mates.
Thanks for listening to episode 2.
Oh, you're talking to them. You're talking to me.
I'm so glad you can edit because you are an absolute Jeb end.
I thought you were talking to me.
Joining us, who?
Exactly.
Anyway, let's going to start this episode by saying a huge thank you to all of you people who not only listened, streamed, downloaded, liked, shared, commented, visited our Podomatic page, but all of the feedback we've got. It's so helpful to us, isn't it, Jem?
It's really helpful. This whole venture is obviously to try and encourage people to talk about difficult things, but it helps you as well. And
massively.
So as long as it does that, then to be honest, we're all set. It's a huge bonus that other people are finding it so useful and being able to empathise or relate to what we're talking about.
Also, it's so lovely to hear that people are using the podcast as a tool to get that conversation starting, that dialogue, whether it be those that suffer from it or those that want to understand more about the disease. It's wonderful. I'm very, very happy. It warms my heart to see so many people engaging. So thank you very much. So how's your week been then? What did you call yourself?
Gemino the Jingle Horse.
Okay. How's your week been, Gemino the Jingle Horse? It makes you sound like a whore.
A whore?
Yeah.
What, like that's a hooker name?
Yeah.
Is it?
I don't know. How's your week been?
It's okay until you just said that.
What, until I called you a whore?
Yeah. Okay, I could have done without that, really, but it's fine. you always call me Gemino. I don't know why, but you like your little nicknames for folk, don't you?
Where
you make their original names longer rather than shorter.
Or I give them a nickname that's so elaborate I spend 20 minutes explaining to them and they never answer to that anyway.
And I'm a little bit fascinated with the line Giddy Up Jingle Horse from Jingle Bell Rock. Yeah.
Haven't you struck up a close relationship with Billy Idol's...
A close relationship is a really, really...
You're friends on Twitter, so you're practically BFFs.
Can you be friends on Twitter? What happened was I asked Billy Idol whether by Jingle Horse he meant reindeer. And he didn't answer me, but his fiance followed me on Twitter. That's a little bit of a strange
friends.
Thing that's going on right now.
Friends.
And I still don't know, but I believe that a reindeer is a jingle horse, and I like it.
It really bums me out that you have asked one question on Twitter, and you've got quite a positive response, I think. I have been badgering Rob Delaney for years.
You should tag him in this.
And I've tried to engage him.
I tried. Remember
you
that?
Tried, yeah. All I want is just a crumb of, not recognition, just attention. And then I'll leave him alone. Well, I won't leave him alone. It'll increase my obsession.
Yeah, he doesn't understand what he's letting himself in for by ignoring you.
So how did you wait? You didn't even answer the initial question.
I didn't. A little bit Groundhog Day, I suppose. I'm working from home this week, yeah. Which is a bonus on the fibromyalgia front, but even for me, it's getting a little bit like I have full-blown conversations with dogs now and rarely see other humans.
Do you feel like it's necessary for you to be out and actually at work for you to benefit?
What do you mean by benefit?
Because I can only assume that initially it was nice to be at home, like you say, fibro-wise. Yeah, are you somebody that requires the human interaction of going into work and seeing people and conversing with people? Is that something that you need?
No, I don't really think that I do.
So you don't miss that?
I still speak to people quite a lot. And actually this year, because everything's a little bit weird and you've got to keep your distance and there's not so many people in work, it's not that different. There still aren't, even if I was physically there aren't that many people that I would have interactions with, so not really. There are a couple of ladies that I work with who are, one of whom loves Christmas and does a Christmas countdown, and just like really fun, loving, great people to be around. I wish I'd seen them a little closer to Christmas, I think.
Yeah,
but no, it doesn't affect my output.
No, I can't imagine it would, but I was just wondering on the person-to-person front, you know, do you miss that interaction?
I don't think I miss it. I think I just I have full-blown conversations with the dogs.
Yeah. Which one of them answers coherently?
I think actually the most vocal is...
Is your dad going to pick me up? Is that how you say? Or is it coherently? Coherently.
I would say coherently.
So I don't want your dad sending me hate mail again. Coherently. Which one answers coherently?
I think the closest to that is probably actually Lucy, because she's from the streets.
I'd like to take this opportunity as well to just give a shout out to all those people that are and have been working from home during the entire lockdown, because I know for a fact there are some people who, on the surface, it looks like a dream to other people, being at home, not having to go to work, not having to travel, etc. But for some people, it's a real, real struggle. Where you end up sleeping, eating, shitting where you work, and there's no outlet from work. It's just constant. And I really feel for those people. And I know there'll be some of you thinking, yeah, I'd love to work from home. But after 9 months, one of our close family members has been working at home for, and it's taken its toll on them. So I just want to give a shout out to all those people that are working from home, because it's a tough gig after this long to keep it up.
And we're social creatures.
Some of us.
Well, I mean, on the whole, I mean...
On your whole? Now do.
I mean, on the whole, as humans, we just are sociable and we would rather be around folk, even if you don't necessarily want to interact and be mates. Just being around other people and normal day-to-day business. I mean, I can't imagine anybody craving... cramming onto the tube and having their face stuck in a stranger's armpit for 20 minutes.
Or having their balls caressed. I had my balls caressed once on the tube. And I'm not talking like an errant elbow rubbed past my Johnson. Somebody fondled my nards. Yeah, somebody fondled my gizzards on the old tube.
I don't like the tube.
No, they did. I don't like the tube. We're digressing anyway.
Yeah, yeah. How has your week been, Ben?
It has been somewhat of an anomaly. Usually... schools are wonderful places to work in at Christmas time. Well, they're wonderful places to work in anyway, if you like that sort of thing, which I do. This year, understandably, the children are exhausted, even though they've adapted incredibly well. The staff are exhausted, and we're not doing the normal Christmas fanfare. No pantomime for poor old Benji. No nativity for poor old Benji.
I was going to say, school does panto.
No, we normally go to the panto in
Spain. Oh, okay.
And it is incredible. But yeah, there's none of that. Oh, shit.
We're going to give a prize away every time Ben
says it. No. Before I continue along that vein, I need to issue an apology. During the editing process for episode 2, I noticed how often I said the word incredible. And I am genuinely sorry. I am currently expanding my vocabulary. Yeah, no nativity, no pantomime for poor old Benji. We can't give the children Christmas cards. And this is all understandable. Can't give them Christmas cards, can't give them presents. And as you know, over the previous 5 years, you have been quite integral in sorting out some really strange presents.
That sounds
no, but like
untoward.
Packing candy bags and
yeah, we have a little elf production line going on at home.
Been a strange week. I'm very eager to finish for the holidays, but I feel sorry for the children. It's not been Christmas at all. And it doesn't help that every day this week I've had conservatively 6 or 7 breakdowns every day where I've pleaded with them. But apart from that, yeah, it's been top draw. Anyway, shall we start this episode with a good old slice of preposterous past procedures? Are you ready for preposterous past procedures, Gemma?
You're showing off now.
Gemma know the jingle horse. You ready?
I am.
Wicked. I worked quite hard to find a PPP that was actually prevalent to mental health, considering that's what the podcast today.
Good,
I think I found one. Are you
Merry
ready?
Merry Christmas to me.
This episode's PPPPP is about orgasmotherapy.
Oh, God.
Orgasmotherapy.
We're going to have to put a warning on this.
We do put one on anyway.
Well, a different kind of warning.
You jackanape. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Before I start this slice of orgasm quiche, just want to give a massive shout out to the Scientific Review of Mental Health Practice website, where I got most of this information from. Right.
That's really creepy.
Let's start this. Orgasmotherapy. It's the brainchild of a gentleman called Wilhelm Reich.
Good name.
Wilhelm Reich. He was a famous psychoanalyst. He was born in 1897 in Austria.
Shock.
He was one of Freud's most promising pupils.
Ah.
Ah. But then he did something, which I couldn't find out what he did, but then I read the article and I kind of figured he did something a little bit nefarious. But whatever he did, it ended up with him being a pariah within the psychiatric community, which I think you have to work really hard to be a pariah in that community. You have to do something pretty weird for people to go, dude, nah. Pavlov's there with his dog going, nah, that, mate, what you're doing is strange. It's, I want to find out what it is.
Plato and Hippocrates waving dog's bums under people's faces.
Oh, that was great last week, by the way.
You're Kudos. Welcome.
Similar to, I'm not going to call him Reich. I'm going to call him Wilhelm because I love saying Wilhelm. Wilhelm had similar theories to Freud about the human libido. Gemma, the libido is where all the sex energy comes from, the sex juice, the sex. Yeah?
Yeah.
Libido.
Yeah.
Wilhelm suggested that humanity's sexual impulses was the major source of its own dysfunction. So all the horn you get, all the boners you pop, that's humanity's source of dysfunction.
Okay.
Which, on the surface, you could probably agree with.
I think probably like 13 to 15-year-olds, maybe, that it kind of consumes your everyday and it's quite distracting after that. It's you know... Unless you're some kind of addict.
But I would say that one of the human race's biggest dysfunction is war. So I read that to be as every time someone has a sexual impulse, it's treated the same as someone bombing a pharmaceutical factory
in
Sudan.
Is war not just fucking a weaker country, though?
You blow my mind. Look at that. Right. Whereas Freud agreed that a controlled inhibition of these impulses was best, was probably the best, you know, sort yourself out. Don't just go around rubbing yourself on folk. Wilhelm was well up for unleashing them. Freud was like, keep them in your pants. And Wilhelm was like, let it all go, bro. Let it all go.
I'll wait for the detail, but I feel like what you're saying is more alarming than was actually suggested.
No. This is exactly what was in that journal. Now, all this is Jen. I read it. This is verbatim from the Scientific Journal of Boner Science. The SG, no, SJOBC. What the shit? The SJBOS. Oh, whatever. Anyway, Wilhelm believed that life was dictated, I love this line, dictated by external quasi-supernatural energies, namely orgones. A certain anybody who likes Peep Show will remember that orgones was something that Jeremy got mixed up in. A sexual life force that was permeating the universe. That's what an orgone is. A sexual life force. Wilhelm proposed that he could harness this force with a metal and steel wool-lined wooden box that he made himself. So just, I'll just repeat that. A metal and steel wool-lined wooden box. A sex coffin. A Brillo-lined sex coffin.
But not for a person.
Yes, for a person. The person went in the box and he... You're jumping ahead. Let me give you the bits, the juice, and then you can.
That's not what it sounded like. It sounded like he was kind of
what trying to contain
the energy or no. the
the force, as it
like
were.
The ghost trap from Ghostbusters. He's putting that in, containing all the boners and all the sexness.
I like how all of the sex stuff you've referred to so far is male.
Well, how can I talk about female stuff? Because
you know it exists.
I've heard about it.
Ah.
Wilhelm claimed that enough time spent in his contraption, a patient's repressions and ailments would melt away. Get in a sex coffin, come out.
I'm still struggling once again, and I don't want to be difficult, but to see what kind of mental health issue they thought this was.
I stopped listening to you after you said, I don't want to be difficult because I know what comes next. Normally it's, I don't want to be difficult, but your weight is a problem. I don't want to be difficult, but can you be a better person? Oh, what? That's not necessary. He claimed that it was a solution to everything from totalitarianism, war, and cancer.
None of these are mental health issues.
This orgasmotherapy, it has no scientific validity.
Shock.
I know. He believed that frequent genital orgasms were a goal of treatment and the key to good health. I've been saying that to you for nearly 11 years.
Are you saying that you wouldn't struggle with mental health issues and this podcast wouldn't exist if I gave you more orgasms?
That is exactly what I'm saying. Let's try it. Let's try it. Let's just try orgasmotherapy. Oh, you don't need to try it.
And then if there's just like a big gap between episode 3 and episode 4, then people would be like, all right.
She cured you. or?
3 days later.
20 seconds later. Yeah, so he believed that just having a toe curler was good for the health. And it's also claimed that he caught the old syphilis, yeah? The old crystals on the old pee-pee. Shaft crystals. Shaft warts? I have no idea. I thought syphilis was shaft warts or like shaft nonsense?
It's a sexually transmitted disease which genuinely caused mental health issues. It caused...
It's apparently it can give you insanity shaft fungi.
It sent people crazy. At one point, the vast majority of people in institutions were people who were suffering from syphilis, yeah.
Dude. Okay, so it's not...
But I don't think it's crystal.
Penis misery.
I don't know if it is, but it might be that as well, which makes it...
Can you imagine
like
being
really
insane
dreadful
and having penis
what
misery?
What is this?
It's a twofer.
Yeah, but at one point, loads and loads of folk who were in institutions were syphilis patients.
Well, here's a question. Do you think the syphilis rate went up once people were committed to asylums because they were all just knocking boots?
I don't know. I don't have access to the statistics.
Wilhelm claimed that the function of the orgasm was to discharge energy particles called orgones, thus maintaining a balance of vital forces. According to Wilhelm, this approach led to dramatic therapeutic results. So he went on to develop his orgone theory. Even the word orgone sounds redonkulous. He also said that a healthy balance of orgone energy is achieved by absorbing orgones from the atmosphere and discharging them via your genitals. Orgasmotherapy is believed to take its place in the same realm as therapeutic touch, Reiki, herbal therapy, chiropractic, which Jen thought was, put that back.
Yes.
No, never heard of this. Naturotherapy, acupuncture, yeah. Pyramid therapy?
No idea.
Shamanism and high colonic enemas.
Shamanism.
There's a lot of bum and front stuff with this. I've not made any of this up. Honestly.
I believe that you haven't made it up.
I feel like you've got beef with my PPP choice.
I feel like, yet again, I don't understand which, if any, mental health issue it's supposed to be addressing.
I didn't realise it had to have anything to do with mental health.
That's the point of the podcast, Ben.
I recognise this now. I think that might just be my thing. Every episode, it's my turn to put a bit of PPP on the old episode. I might just pick something totally unrelated to mental health. It is related a little bit.
But it's going to get more and more elaborate, isn't it? And it's just going to be any nonsense therapy for anything going forward.
Maybe it will. We'll just have to ride that camel out and see what happens. That's a phrase. That is a phrase. Shut up.
All right.
I heard someone say, it talked about inhibitions and sexual hunger, I don't know.
None of those are mental health issues.
Then why does it make me feel so bad? Okay, can we agree? Right, so it didn't have anything to do with mental health. I'm not apologising because I just wanted to bring orgones into our lives. And I think you'll be thanking me. Pretty soon. Episode is share some of the things, some of the tricks and strategies that I've used over many, many years of suffering depression that helps me get through those times. And I think they'll be quite useful for some people. Again, it's not a one size fits all prescription. Might work for me, won't work for anyone else. But the reason why we decided to share this in this episode, and I am quite surprised that we are sharing in this episode. However, I do think it's incredibly important that we do discuss this. And just a heads up, it's going to get quite heavy, but I assume you would be aware of that considering you're listening to a podcast about mental health. Right, first national lockdown. I hit bottom, didn't I? And I thought I was dealing with things quite well, still taking my medication. Absolutely everything was perfect at home, really working as much as I normally work.
Your routine changed, so you're in kind of fits and starts.
Yeah, which is never a good thing, because anyone that knows me and Gemma will attest to this, that it's vital for me to be active and it's vital for me to have something to do, because if I don't, inactivity is breeding ground. If I can sit around thinking, I will manage to convince myself what a total piece of shit I am in 20 minutes, and that's it, that's a week ruined. And that's not an exaggeration, it's spiral. So yeah, May was quite tough for me, but it was also incredibly tough for Gemma. Around about, I think, well, it was May the 6th, it come to a head. Nothing particularly bad had happened. You know, we'd had a good day together, didn't we? We were in the garden. I'd spoken with very good friends of mine, video call, obviously. And then Gemma went to bed because I was just rude to her.
And I had to be up at 5 a.m. for work.
Oh, yeah. And you had to be up super early. And I just stayed downstairs drinking, and things kind of got away from me. And I just remember thinking that I just felt too much. I felt like a drain. I didn't feel like I'd ever change. I didn't feel like it was something that you could fix, or something that you had to carry. I felt like such a burden. And I remember I wrote a note and I addressed it to you and explained how I felt and why I felt that way. And nothing was to do. None of the reasons for my decision were related to you or unhappiness or my family or friends. It was just something that ultimately I always envisaged that would be what would happen to me, just because I suffered from depression and I'd thought about this before, and sometimes it got so heavy and so encapsulating that I thought, well, it's the only way out. I'll never beat it. Yeah, and it was very, very late. I finished writing the note. I was very upset while I was writing it, but also incredibly relieved that this was the decision I was going to make. I took two tablecloths out of the kitchen drawer and fashioned quite a robust noose out of them. This was quite late on in the evening, probably early hours of the morning. I went outside very quietly, and I went to, there's this huge, stunning tree at the back of our house, and it's one that, Jem, you were drawn to, weren't you, when we were buying the house, because it was...
I love it. It's under a conservation project. It's a black poplar tree.
And I went outside, went to the tree, and walked over to the base of the tree, and I looked up, and I put it round my neck. And then as soon as it went round my neck, I got really, really scared, really nervous. And then almost like I woke up, I was slapped in the face, and I just stopped and I shivered, and I took it off my neck. I turned around, I walked back to the house. I sat down at the table. I took the tablecloths and just left them. We'll get onto that. I left them in the kitchen. I threw away the note, and I just remember thinking, that's not what I want. And I don't want to be dead. I didn't want to not be around anymore. And it was a strangely euphoric sensation. and it was one that I wasn't expecting, and it really scared me how close I got to that. But since then, I have felt obsessed, driven to ensuring that whenever anyone feels that way, regardless of my relationship with them or how little or how well I know them, you have to be there for people. And I want to be there for people. I want to talk to people that get to that point. I want to explain to them that there's a way out and a way back. But also, I think it's really important that you have your time to talk.
I think it's a really interesting turn of events, this one, because as people, who, you know, anyone who knows me and people who've listened to the last two episodes will know that I've had personal experience of somebody close to me taking their own life, and the day after, I know that you had gone to sleep in the spare room, which is something that you will sometimes do if you've had a bit too much to drink and I've got to be up early and you don't want to disturb me, which is quite a considerate thing. So I didn't think much of that. And then when I got down to the kitchen, when I got up in the morning for work and went down to the kitchen, kind of took my breath away, because the noose was just hanging over one of the kitchen chairs and I hadn't actually popped my head in yet, so I ran back upstairs and made sure that you were actually in the house, and literally just checked that you were breathing, but then I didn't really know what to do, so I just went to work. And I remember it really vividly because a good friend of mine, Jodie, was, who'd been on night, so I was taken over from her. And she made some joke about some video you sent to like a WhatsApp group or something that we have, or I don't know, something you posted somewhere. And I just couldn't respond at all. And it was a little while after when I said to her, you know, this is what was happening that day. And she's like, oh, I just thought you were tired and or in a mood. But that's the thing, you know, not just people who suffer, but people who live with people who suffer and care for them. I don't mean care like a carer, you know, love them. We're so good at hiding when things aren't right. And Jodie's one of my best friends and she had absolutely no idea. And then, just before I went into work, I messaged your friend, Brendan, because I didn't know what else to do. And tried to explain. And because this sounds probably a little bit nuts, but normally in my job, I can't have my phone at work. So it's not like if anything had happened and I was there, that somebody would be able to get hold of me very quickly. So I gave Brendan my work number and said to give me a ring if anything happened or if he managed to get hold of him when he was awake. And I managed, I think, until about probably 9 o'clock before I started crying in work. And, you know, it's not my normal modus operandi, and people were noticing. My boss asked me what was going on. I had slipped her a little note earlier on in the morning, just said, I don't want to talk about it, but if a guy called Brendan calls, I might need to leave quite quickly. And sent me home. And when I got home, you weren't at home and your car wasn't here. And I had no idea what was going on. And then actually, it was incredibly painful. And I don't think I'm ever going to not cry when I recall those moments. But as soon as I spoke to you, and I realised that actually you were, I would say fine, but you were all right,
I felt better. You'd gone to Tesco and said, oh, and you're like, why are you home? I said, oh, I just don't do terribly well with untying a noose at 5 o'clock in the morning before I go to work. And that was the moment we both realised that you thought that you'd untied it before you went to bed.
Yeah.
And you hadn't. Because obviously when you came down into the kitchen in the morning, it was just 2 tablecloths, which I probably would still have thought was a bit strange. But and then when you said, I'll come home straight away, when you came back, we sat and talked for a long time. And that was when you said to me about how you had always assumed since you'd started suffering with depression that that would be like there wasn't really any other option, that that was the way you were going to go. And in that moment when you had that around your neck, that actually you it was like an epiphany and you thought, it doesn't have to be.
No.
So for you, it was a kind of watershed, quite positive moment. But for me, and I'm not, you know.
Don't have to.
Though I'm not making it about me, but because of what I've gone through previously, being that close and being fast asleep and having no idea was just terrifying. And as much as you tell me that now you don't think that's the way you're going to go or that you know there's another way, I don't know that. I can never know that. And I just think it's difficult. I think it's almost impossible to banish those thoughts when you've already being close to someone who's done it. So, you know, I never want you to feel guilty, ever. I don't think about it all the time by any stretch. And this is probably the first time in about 6 months that I've cried about it. But for me, that possibility never goes away.
I know. And it's the... It might seem like a really sadistic thing to do, to talk about this and record it and record how upset you are and me record the details of what happened. But it is vital that people understand that this is what happens when you're with someone who has mental health issues. It's not just the person who's suffering. It's the person that's with them. And I will never forget your reaction to me when I'm not going to lie, I was pretty normal the next day. And this is the thing that I think upset you the most. You'd gone through something incredibly traumatic once, and then quite possibly for the second time, having to experience it a second time, and me being just normal with you on the phone. And, you know, I genuinely believe that's the thing that threw you the most. But that's how I felt relieved. And then it's afterwards when you start considering, I can't believe I put her through that, and I can't believe that it would have been another time when she would have had to experience it.
But this is why we can speak with relative authority, like we did in, I think, the first episode about, you know, talking about people who are suicidal and the whole selfish thing, that it's not selfish at all.
No.
And obviously you considered me. I remember asking you whether if the note you wrote was to me, which you said it was. And I saw that. I saw it, and we got these little cute kitchen bins that I got you from eBay, probably. And it was screwed up in there, and I found it, and not one little bit of me wanted to open it up and read what was in there.
I'm glad you didn't, because I think that would have... I would not want to discuss that with you, because... This sounds really perverse and a little bit backwards, but in a way, I will never, ever truly be able to voice how sorry I was that I put you through that. And you'll never realise how sorry I was. But in one way, I am glad that you found that, because I would have just carried on as normal. And had you not found it, then I would have... I would not have been able to talk to you about how I felt regarding suicide not being an option. And as painful as it is for you, and I'm not a selfish person, I've never been a selfish person, but quite selfishly, I think as painful as it is for you, it's cathartic for me. And that's probably as selfish as I get. It just so happens to be one of the most obscene things that I've done.
I don't think that is selfish. I think it's just true. It was that for you. It had already been that for you, and I just didn't know. The only, you know, the hiccup in the entire plan, if you will, was that you were drunk bitches and you thought you'd untied it and you hadn't. And if you had, then maybe I would have gone, that's a bit weird that there's some tablecloths on the side or draped over the chair, and wouldn't have thought twice about it. But that's not what happened.
No.
And I don't think for one moment that you were aware the moment that you put that down. I don't think you considered that I would find that and the repercussions. But I think it's been enlightening, I suppose. I think definitely for you, even before I saw anything or had any awareness, you had quite an important discussion with your parents recently,
yeah,
where actually they expressed little surprise, which...
they reacted in a way I never thought they'd react.
Yeah, but in a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm sorry.
I don't want you to be sorry.
I know you've never expected an apology, and I know you're not a person, but you know what I'm sorry for? I'm sorry that there are times when you get overlooked in situations. People talk about me, my mental health issues, but there are issues because I didn't suffer alone. And as long as you've been with me, you've suffered too. And this is, I think one of the worst times you've suffered.
Yeah, I mean,
but no one thinks about that.
Well, some people do, you know. People
My sister
will.
Did.
Yeah, Mel's great. She always asks how I am. People do ask. People who I've been last unit that I was at when I was at Digby, I was coordinating a support network there, and they were really good. Whenever we'd have meetings, they would, you know, I'd say, "How's everybody doing? Have you had any interaction with people?" And they would always ask me as well. You know, the people on the committee. So. People do ask, but at the same time, you're not going to go, oh, yeah, by the way, this happened. So it's
Some people do, and yeah. that's fine. But when you're...
I wouldn't.
The way you're programmed, I don't mean that.
No, yeah, I mean, absolutely. The way you're programmed just wouldn't.
You're not someone who airs your laundry in public. But it's really important that, the people that are alongside you that are suffering get support as well. Thankfully, the people that did know were incredibly supportive of you and, you know, made sure that you're okay. And it wasn't a large group of people, but the people that did know really came to the fore and supported you by also mocking me at the same time.
Nobody mocked you.
Yes, they did.
Who mocked you?
Brendan and Alan mocked me.
I think we both know there's a huge stigma with people who struggle with mental health issues talking about how they struggle. Did I just say struggle twice?
Yeah, you did. Dickhead.
I think we both know, as do most people, that there's a huge stigma about people who have mental health issues. There isn't usually that much focus on the people with whom they live or people who care for them. And I'm not getting my violin out and I'm not asking for people to...
No, but this is the platform to discuss that because we
Yeah, no, to discuss it, that's fine. But like now, I'm always going to get upset by that story. But I'm okay.
You do need to get over it.
You shut the fuck up. But in general, people who look after people who or support people who struggle with mental health issues always feel maybe like they are doing a bit of that, like,
yeah,
you know, what about me? And it isn't that, you know, it takes a toll and sometimes you just have to reach out. That wasn't for me. And this is actually what made it so difficult. Wasn't one of those times where you've been really down for a long time and I can feel something
bubbling.
This was
out of the blue.
Exactly. So those times I can say, this is likely to have a bit of a knock-on effect on me. It's a difficult thing, you know, it's going on over a long time and I'll speak to people. But it was completely out of the blue. And I found that immeasurably more difficult because it's that kind of how can you not see this coming?
Yeah.
And it does echo back for me to when my mum took her life and the day, I mean, it was kind of a day going into an evening and then overnight when she actually did it. And we were all in a beer garden. It was August. It was a beautiful day. We were laughing and joking. And it just happens like that. Actually, I think more often than not, I think unless you're somebody who is in a situation of psychosis or breakdown, if you're someone who's just going through run-of-the-mill everyday things and suffer from depression, that it's more likely to creep up on you in those circumstances. And that's fucking terrifying for me because I saw my mum do it. I did all my training. I've been doing suicide intervention for 7 years now, at least.
Yeah.
7, 8 years. And mental health first aid. And I've seen it in a lot of people. I've seen the warning signs. And you were in my house talking to me that day. And I had no idea. And that terrifies me.
You are unequivocally allowed to voice your concerns and voice how it made you feel and voice how you are worried if it happens again and beating yourself up because you didn't see it coming. That is absolutely your right. And this is one of those situations where this conversation might infuriate a few people. It might make people think differently about me. But I need this conversation to be one of those things that happens without judgment, without you predicating anything you say with, I know it sounds bad or, it's not about me. This is about us. We suffered as a unit and we get through things as a unit and you deserve your time to talk about how it made you feel without you saying, I know it sounds bad or I'm sorry or I feel guilty. So you say whatever you need to.
You're a unit.
I know. That's what they call me on the streets. Unit B.
B unit.
B unit.
What is it time for, Ben?
Oh, that's not true, mate.
It gets more ridiculous every time.
It will.
Okay. For this episode, we have decided to focus on misconceptions to do with mental health conditions and gender. Essentially, I'm sure you'll agree, there are certain mental health conditions people consider linked to specific genders. The ones we're going to focus on, PTSD being generally considered not only almost exclusively for males, but also for soldiers and armed forces personnel, on eating disorders being exclusively for women. I'm sure that many of you are probably grimacing right now thinking, well, I know that that's not the case, but
I've definitely been guilty in the past of making those assumptions based on gender, but we'd like to clear that up today. There's quite a few things as well that I didn't know. There are between 1.25 and 3.4 million people in the UK that are affected by eating disorders, and out of those people, 25% are male.
Yeah, and obviously within those figures, that means overwhelmingly that the vast majority are either female or perhaps non-binary. But the prevalence alone of eating disorders, I think, would shock quite a lot of people. Yeah. And that kind of leads on very quickly to the issue that people think eating disorders is just anorexia when you don't eat anything and you overexercise and you eventually die. And of course it isn't. It's anything where somebody essentially uses control over their calorie intake and their exercise as a means of control. That can come about from any feeling or perception of loss of control in their life, and that's why you tend to see it a lot in teenagers, because they're in that kind of point in their life where they feel like they should be taking more control but they can't because their parents are still telling them all the rules and what they need to do. That's where it, and I'm not discounting the problems of dysmorphia and, yeah, and things like that that also go along with it, and the image problems. But in my experience, and I have dealt with people who are struggling with mental health issues and eating disorders, it's almost always a lack of control and it's a way of taking some of that back.
So yeah, sorry, a little aside there, but even within eating disorders as a condition themselves, people tend to misconstrue what that actually means. But lots and lots of men, and I think it's on the increase, are finding that that's something to find control in.
Yeah, and the more men attend gyms, the more men that purchase men's health magazines, the more we're exposed to celebrity detox diets and this and that, the more pressure that's applied from various positions in society, it affects more people. Obviously, growing up with two sisters, there were always magazines around, and you'd pick a magazine up, and it, 9 times out of 10, it would be image focused or weight focused, the headline, the articles, and you don't have that for males, not available to teenagers. The older you get, when you become an adult male, that's when it is presented to you, but in a completely different way. It's delivered to you in a different way. It's not weight based, it's image based, it's abs.
Yeah.
And it's I don't know if gendered is the right term, but the way it's delivered to the different genders has a lot to do with those figures, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could say that if the image they're projecting is that somebody is lean and muscly, that it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not like a size zero model walking down a catwalk and looking like their legs are going to give way. So people might say, well, that's promoting people being healthy, but everybody's different, and some yeah. people's bodies just aren't capable of ever looking like that, or their circumstances mean that they can't look like that, and it's unrealistic. And it's that kind of thing that you need to focus on, that I think you're right, these days is way more prevalent for men than it was in the past.
It's still packaged differently, isn't it?
It's packaged differently.
More positively to men than it is to women.
But the results are essentially the same.
They are.
But like I say, you're focusing there on the image aspect. And when people actually have eating disorders, a lot of the time it's not that much to do with image. It's about control. And they might look at pictures of someone and say, I want to look like that. But the reason they want to look like that is because that epitomises that control yeah. for them, and I'm the one in charge of what's going on here, and that is absolutely not gender specific. So it's just one of those things which people, you know, we spoke about this briefly earlier before we decided to record. If every time you finished your family meal a girl was disappearing off to the bathroom for 15 minutes, you'd probably think, oh, hang on a minute, that's not quite right. Maybe I need to ask some questions. But how many people, parents or whoever, would ask the same question of a teenage lad?
They wouldn't. Well, no, they wouldn't. No way would they. It wouldn't be. It wouldn't even enter their country. Actually, it'd probably be joked about.
I mean, we don't know.
It wouldn't be treated with any.
I'm sure there are some families out there who are alert to the possibilities. But in this day and age, people really need to be aware that it is absolutely not just females that suffer from eating disorders. Yep.
Strongly agree. If you'd like any more information about support for eating disorders, you can visit www.beateatingdisorders.org.uk or www.eatingdisorders.hope. I've got the next myth in a headlock. What's the next myth, Jem?
It's that PTSD is exclusively something suffered by males. And actually, I don't think most people believe that, but, you know, predominantly, hugely predominantly. And it is. The majority of people who do suffer from PTSD are males, and the armed forces community plays a huge role in that, as in, you know, soldiers going out to war, most of them are males, and they are likely to see and experience things that the average Joe probably won't. But there are many experiences which people encounter in everyday life that are never considered really in terms of PTSD, childbirth being one of them. And, you know, there'll be so many people, you always hear the stories, oh yeah, you know, I pushed twins out and then I was home 2 hours later cooking the dinner. All right, you know, bully for you. That's not everybody's story.
Yeah.
And sometimes people have hemorrhages and they have to have transfusions and they have really horrific, terrible times giving birth. Obviously, it doesn't diminish how they feel about their children in any way, but it's a really, really traumatic thing. It's a really, really traumatic thing, both psychologically and physically. Definitely, people suffer post-traumatic stress disorder after particularly difficult childbirth, yeah. shall we say.
I've got some statistics here. 3% of the population in the UK, adult population in the UK, suffer from PTSD. here are some of the causes of PTSD. Here are some of the causes of PTSD. Serious accidents, physical or sexual assault, abuse, health problems, childbirth experiences, which you've just spoken about, war and conflict and torture. So I would always have thought that PTSD was conflict related. So when I read this, it was quite interesting.
I mean, I suppose when you look at, if you watch any grim medical programs like I do the time, you know, and they would refer to trauma units and trauma doctors.
Yeah.
You know, it's called that for a reason. You don't have to be at war to suffer a trauma. A horrible accident can definitely trigger PTSD. And something which is particularly pertinent at the moment, which again I alluded to in a separate conversation with you earlier, was that I have a friend who was raped as a teenager and suffers from PTSD to this day. I'm not going to give details that would in any way identify that person, but for that reason, that person cannot wear a mask because they have flashbacks, and it's a huge trigger for them having their mouth covered in that way. And I think there's so much hostility and hatred towards people, even if they are wearing the sunflower lanyard, to say I really can't wear a mask, you know, really aggressive behavior. And I suppose I'd just say, if you can, you absolutely should, because there are people that want to but can't. And it's not a little thing that they should get over. That's a huge traumatic experience in their life, and it is transporting them back to that every single time they consider doing that. And actually, the person that I'm talking about was surprised by it themselves. They didn't realize that that would be a trigger, but it was. Have some compassion if somebody isn't wearing a mask.
It's a difficult thing to do, but take 5 seconds before you cast judgment or...
Exactly. And, the fact that I know that person wants to be able to wear one, but can't.
Hi, guys. I know that might have been quite difficult to listen to, but it was something that needed to be shared. I think it was helpful for both me and Jem to discuss that.
It was also actually the catalyst which encouraged Ben to want to make this podcast in the first place. So as I've said many times, as long as it helps Ben, if it helps anybody else, that's a bonus. That event was what gave him the idea of talking more and trying to get that point across to people that there is another way. Right up until you make that decision, there's always another way.
I couldn't agree more. And yet the weight of the situation is not lost on me. But what's come out of it, the positivity, the way I feel, the way I've changed towards my own illness and helping others has been quite radical. I genuinely feel a desire to just be there for people, because I know that in my hour of need, what I used to get me through is people understanding and people support. Catalyst is a fantastic word, and that's what I think that whole situation, that whole experience became for me and you. I can imagine it's uncomfortable to hear. And there are times it is uncomfortable for me to discuss, but we don't get anywhere without talking. Let's keep that conversation going.